From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1868 when the first president in U.S. history was impeached. The House of Representatives voted on 11 articles of impeachment against Andrew Johnson, the nation's 17th president. 9 of the 11 articles were related to Johnson's removal of the Secretary of War, Edmund Stanton, which was a violation of the Tenure of Office Act. That act, passed the year before, prevented presidents from removing officials confirmed by the Senate without Senate approval. Johnson was impeached on February 24, 1868. His trial began in the Senate in March of that year. After about 2 months, the trial ended, with Johnson's opponents failing to achieve the two-thirds majority to convict him. Johnson is one of 3 U.S. presidents to have been impeached. The other 2 are President Bill Clinton and now President Donald Trump. Yesterday, House Dems introduced an article of impeachment against President Trump. A vote is scheduled for tomorrow to charge Trump with inciting violence against the government of the United States. If he's impeached, he will become the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. And of course, Richard Nixon would have been impeached and could have been facing removal, but he resigned. As we watch the process unfold over the next several days, there are other issues in play. There have been calls for the use of the 25th Amendment, which includes a section that states a president can be removed from office if deemed by the vice president or Congress unable to perform the duties of office. Our guests this hour explain what we need to know about impeachment, the 25th Amendment, the purpose of going in these directions, and what could happen next in the nation's capital. And we'll have this conversation, as we just heard, from President Trump. He made some comments to reporters, looked like getting off plane today, and said that everything he said in his speech on January 6th was totally appropriate. He said the experts have analyzed his words and found everything he said was appropriate. And that perfect words, perfect words. Even though he used the word fight or fighting 24 times in an hour. And said that he was going to go with those supporters to the Capitol. Perfect, he said. Now, he also said he doesn't want more violence. And he said that if impeachment happens, his supporters are going to be very angry. Sounds a lot like a threat. Let's bring in our guest to talk about this. Aaron Harold is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations, a coordinator of legal studies, and co-director of the Forum on Constitutionalism and Democracy at SUNY Geneseo. Professor, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me today. It's great to be here.
Jeremy Scherer is the founding partner and litigation attorney at a Rochester firm named Adams LeClair and co-leader of Indivisible Rochester. Jeremy, welcome.
Thanks very much, Evan.
Yeah, can you just tell us a little bit about, for listeners who don't know what Indivisible is, tell us what it is.
Sure. Thanks for asking. Well, Indivisible is a grassroots group that was formed nationally after Trump became elected with the goal of leveraging just individual constituents' power to influence government. And local chapters rose up all over the country. Indivisible Rochester is a group of approximately 2,000 people who just want to get more involved in government and support progressive causes.
Yeah, and, you know, Jeremy, I was going to ask you at the outset if what we saw last Wednesday is the culmination of what your concerns were 4 years ago. But that would sort of ignore so many other things that have happened. It's almost like we've already forgotten about the phone call with Raffensperger in Georgia, which, from my lay estimation, and we can talk about this, is worse than anything Richard Nixon did. And then we find out there was a second phone call made to a Georgia official in which he was asking them to come up with fraud evidence, come up with it. Those phone calls on their own seem to rise to a level of impeachable offense, and it's like we have forgotten them. Anyway, I was going to ask you, Jeremy, if what happened last Wednesday is part of the reason that you got involved with Indivisible in the first place, a fear of something like that.
Of course. When a president takes power and espouses disdain for democratic values, then we all have to be worried. And the response has to be reaffirming those same democratic values. And that means knowing more about who represents us, what their powers are, and how to make them support rather than show indifference to our democracy.
Well, let's talk about what's going to be happening here. couple reporters reporting today that Republican leaders are now concerned in the House of Representatives that 10 to 20 Republicans could vote for conviction, could support the impeachment proceedings, that you're going to have essentially all the Democrats and 10 to 20 total Republicans in the House. That's what we could be looking at in the next few days. But there's a long process here. Professor Harold, when it comes to impeachment, you know, I probably grew up like a lot of people hearing the word impeachment. And the first thing you think is impeachment. If you're impeached, you're removed. That's not the case. Tell me a little bit about this process and what it is designed to do, how it's it is designed as a mechanism.
So impeachment is a two-stage process, and it's not a criminal process, but I would say that it is analogous to the process in a criminal proceeding of indictment by a grand jury and then trial and possibly conviction in a courtroom by a 12-person jury. So what will happen is it seems like tomorrow, most likely, the House of Representatives will vote to impeach President Trump. And then the articles of impeachment will be, and that takes only a simple majority vote. And then the articles of impeachment will be delivered to the Senate at some future time. And the Senate would at some point try Trump. And if this sounds like deja vu, it's because a lot has happened between since now and last year. But around this time last year, we were talking about the same thing. And there would be a trial in the Senate, and all the senators would take a new oath, and the Senate, in effect, would reconstitute itself into a courtroom and with 100 jury members, and that trial would be presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, and it would take a two-thirds majority of the senators to convict Trump. After conviction, with a simple majority vote, he could be disqualified from holding federal public office again.
Okay, so this is important, and I want to make sure I just emphasize the rules here. On the House side, what are the numbers needed to advance this to the Senate?
A simple majority vote.
Okay, and they can get that.
So far as I've been told, as I've read, already a majority of senators have signed on to the impeachment article.
A majority of House members.
Yeah, House members. Sorry,
yes.
Excuse me.
And then when it comes to the U.S. Senate, you know, you almost certainly would have Mitt Romney again. There was I think Murkowski. Lisa Murkowski has come out and said she wants Trump removed any way possible. I mean, you may have several. It doesn't strike me as likely that you've got two-thirds, but that's all speculation. I don't know.
Yeah. You would need 17 Republicans. And that's, I don't know. Some of them, to be cynical, some of them, you know, may have presidential aspirations. Perhaps they don't want Trump to run again.
I'm not sure you could get Joe Manchin.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
well, I don't know.
Okay, so anyway, the bottom line is that would be the process. Then, interestingly enough, let's just hypothetically say you've got 67, you've got a conviction. The idea that he would be barred from running for future office is not automatic, is what you're saying. There would need to be a simple majority vote subsequent to that conviction for his opportunity to run for future office also barred. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And that's a matter of the Senate rules, I believe.
Okay, which seems entirely likely to me, that if you had 67 votes in the Senate to convict on impeachment, then you would almost certainly would also have a barring from office. But that has to be separate.
Yeah, that seems likely to me, too.
Okay, but that has to be separate. Now, there strikes me as no way any of this happens before Joe Biden is inaugurated. Is that correct?
That seems to be correct. From what I understand, the Senate is currently out of session. So and it would take the unanimous consent of all 100 senators to come back into session before January 19th. And so that's very unlikely to happen. So it seems at this point as though if there is an impeachment, that seems likely, any Senate trial would take place after Trump has left office.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a scenario that is mentioned in the Constitution, but apparently there is precedent that I think in the past, I forget the exact circumstances, but executive branch officials have been impeached and then tried after they have left office.
To be clear, though, the U.S. Senate would have to unanimously agree to come back and deal with this in an expedited fashion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I don't think Josh Hawley's coming back for this.
No,
that's just
no.
My thought. Okay. So that's not going to happen, but we could see this happen after Biden's inauguration. And if you're wondering what the point of that would be, I'll ask Jeremy Scherer. When people say, look, move on. Biden's about to be president next week. Get on with it and then leave this all in the past. We don't need 100 days into a Biden administration, we don't need a Senate trial. Why do we need to do that? Do you want to see that happen, Jeremy?
I do. And I just want to know what you said about the 100 days, because Jim Clyburn, the majority whip for the Democrats in the House, has put forth the idea of passing the articles of impeachment in the House, but then not having the Senate proceed with the trial until at least 100 days after Biden is inaugurated, because of the symbolic importance of those first 100 days in Biden's priority to appoint his cabinet and get his initiatives underway. So the House has the power to control when it delivers those articles of impeachment to the Senate and the trial begins. So, but to answer your broader question, yes, there is a difficulty here, because even if we could do this immediately, there are downsides to trying the impeachment case immediately, and there are downsides to waiting. There is no great solution to dealing with sedition when there isn't unanimity among the parties on how to and how to go forward. So, but something must be done. Democrats, and I hope a sizable number of Republicans, need to understand that a line has been crossed past all the other lines that Trump has crossed, where we are now dealing with sedition, with open violence and bloodshed that has led to deaths, and leaving an impeachment and just setting it aside because the timing is inconvenient, essentially invites this kind of unacceptable conduct from lame duck presidents in the future.
I would agree with that. I would say that the best argument against impeaching Trump and doing this retroactive trial would be that, look, what's President Biden's main task, President-elect Biden's main task when he becomes President Biden? It's to undo the tremendous damage to American institutions and American political norms that the Trump administration has carried out. If the trial goes on in the first 2 weeks, or even if the charges are delayed for 100 days, you know, 3 months into the new presidency, Trump's presidency effectively continues, or we're still dealing with the shadow of Trump's presidency. On the other hand, and I think I lean more towards this, there needs to be an unequivocal moral condemnation of what happened last Wednesday, and as well as an assertion by Congress of its status as a co-equal branch of government, and as the branch of government that is the only branch of government that is directly elected by the American people. And so in the same way that a guilty verdict in a criminal procedure can begin the healing process and the moving forward process for a community, I think you could make a good argument that an impeachment followed by a conviction could begin that process for us as a country on January 20th.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments about impeachment, the 25th Amendment, and the days and weeks to come here, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program's toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And we're going to get through a lot of your points or questions, and I'm going to start with Chase, who's asking, a distinction I need clarity on. Will the Senate hold the can't hold office simple majority vote regardless of the outcome of an impeachment trial that requires a supermajority? Can they and would they? Professor Harold, that's an interesting question, because right now my assumption is even another impeachment trial won't result in a conviction. Of course, there's a lot of things that could change. Who knows what's going to happen next? I'm done predicting politics. But could, even if we never get there, could there be a separate vote to can't hold office, or does it require impeachment conviction first?
So the Article 1 of the Constitution says that sorry, Article 2 of the Constitution, excuse me, says that a two-thirds majority is required to convict, and that penalties shall not extend further than removal from office and disqualification to serve in future office. So the Constitution itself is actually a little unclear on that point, but my understanding is that Senate rules are that you must have a two-thirds vote to convict, and then and only then can you have a vote to disqualify.
It's like a sentencing option.
Yeah.
If there's a conviction first. Okay. So the answer...
I'm also told that there's a kind of debate on legal Twitter about this right now. So
okay,
I don't actually know.
I mean, look, we're in territory we haven't really been in.
Yeah.
The point to Chase is it doesn't look like that could happen, but we don't know for sure. And there is debate. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd say the majority view is that the overwhelming majority view is that a conviction is necessary before the Senate can reach disqualification.
Okay. Now, on the subject of the 25th Amendment, there's of course more debate about what its intention is and if it fits these times, and then if the people who could trigger it are willing to do it. And Vice President Pence has apparently indicated multiple times that he is not. But Professor Harold, how do we see the 25th Amendment as relevant to these circumstances?
Okay, so the 25th Amendment was added to the Constitution in the 60s after the Kennedy assassination, and it was added in order to clear up some ambiguities about the presidential line of succession, which were unclear in the original Constitution and which became much more important in the Cold War and the nuclear era. And Section 4, which is the relevant section for our purposes, which has never been invoked except for on TV shows like 24, provides for a scenario in which the president could be involuntarily removed from office if the vice president and the majority of the cabinet or the majority of another body designated by Congress for this purpose declared him, quote, unable to perform his duties of office. So unlike impeachment, this would not be about responding to presidential bad behavior. This was originally intended, I think, for a situation like was faced at the end of the Wilson administration, where Wilson had a stroke and was actually incapacitated for about a year, it wasn't clear who was actually running the country. That said, it gives no definition of what it means to be unable to perform his duties of office. Does it? If Trump is morally and psychologically and intellectually unfit to be president, can they do this? And I think they could. And actually, according to the terms of the 25th Amendment, if Trump were to contest the decision, so as soon as this happened, Vice President Pence would become acting president. Trump could contest the decision, and Congress, if he did that, Congress would have to decide the issue by a two-thirds majority of both houses. But it has 21 days to do that. Which means that if Pence were to do this and the cabinet were to do this today, they could effectively run out the clock on Trump's presidency.
Okay. It doesn't sound like that's going to happen, but Jeremy, sure, is that something you would want to see happen?
Absolutely. The 25th Amendment and impeachment can be pursued simultaneously, and there's no reason not to if the president poses a threat to the functioning of government and the lives of the people who work in the Capitol. And in state houses throughout the country.
Well, before I take my first phone call, to be clear, Jeremy, do you feel that the president does pose a threat to lives, whether in the Capitol or other locations?
I do, because the president has not not given an unequivocal order to his supporters to cease violence of all kinds. And also importantly, and this goes to the issue of whether impeachment is unnecessarily inflammatory, he still hasn't conceded. He still hasn't truly conceded. He hasn't said Joe Biden has won the election fairly and legitimately, and that Joe Biden will be the new president and we should support Biden as a legitimate president of this country. And until he does that, there is always the potential for additional violence, maybe even if he does. But he hasn't done that. And I want to make one more point about that. He also has done nothing to brief the nation or provide information about the insurrection at the Capitol. We've had a complete blackout ever since it happened 6 days ago. So because the phrase because the term in the 25th Amendment is simply unable to discharge the duties of office, there's no requirement for a medical certification or a mental illness analysis. I do believe he meets that standard, and it should be invoked.
Let me take John in Penfield first on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hi, gentlemen. You know, I've heard this debate for the last several days. I actually got up this morning and I read the transcript of President Trump's speech at that rally. And I don't see anything in that speech. So I would challenge all of your listening audience to download the transcript, to read the words that he said.
Okay.
And if you draw a rational conclusion.
No, John. So
he says peace,
John,
peacefully.
John,
yes.
I want to ask you a question, seriously, because I understand what you're saying here. Are you aware of QAnon? Are you familiar with the rhetoric and the beliefs of millions of people, apparently, who support Trump and believe those ideas?
No, I don't know the details of QAnon.
Okay.
I'm saying Trump supporters are much broader than what you're alluding
not
to.
Not the ones who were at the Capitol. John.
Evan, you're inciting divisiveness.
No, John.
To your guest. Okay. If the Democrats proceed through impeachment, they're only creating, sowing the seeds for more violence. Violence can never be condoned, ever. Can never be condoned. And Trump, peaceful protesters were on the Capitol. They're violating the laws protecting the building. They were wrong. An innocent woman was murdered, okay? But to blame the president...
An innocent woman was murdered.
I don't get that. Yes. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, is the president in charge of the Capitol Police? Did the president know that the Capitol Police were not going to defend that institution?
All right. We're going to stop the call here, and I'm going to say, John, thanks for the call. I understand you think that we are concluding something hyperbolic about the president's rhetoric. So I just want to address this point, and then I'll let our guests weigh in if they want to. And I don't mean to do this in a way that is divisive, John. I mean, I don't want to be divisive. I didn't want to be right about this president. When Donald Trump said, 4 years ago, that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue in New York City and not lose a single supporter, that turned out to be true, or mostly true, and that turned out to be something that we should have all asked ourselves, why? Why is that? What is happening that would be true? What is a movement doing when somebody could commit such violence? Are we supporting ideas? Are we supporting goals of whatever version of progress we have in this country? Or are we worshiping a person? And when the person brags that he could go shoot somebody randomly on the street and nobody would care, we've reached a point where we are not voting for ideas. We're not voting for the kind of progress that we want politically. There's something different happening. This is not new. We didn't want to be right about this. What happened last Wednesday was the culmination of a number of factors of which Trump is now aware. He would not condemn conspiracy theories that in which people are believing, John, even if you don't, lots and lots of people are believing that there are sex rings, there are kids being sold in Washington by political leaders. I mean, if it sounds wild to you, maybe it should, but people believe this. I'm not mocking the people who believe it. I'm very worried about this, and I want to keep talking about why we get there, because we got to get away from there. When they ran into that pizza shop, so-called Pizzagate, and started shooting, people could have been killed there. Turned out there was no basement with a chamber for kids, and that didn't convince them that whole thing was wrong. They just thought, well, we must have the wrong pizza shop. When they went to the Capitol, John, there was an idea of what was going to happen. They set up a gallows outside, man. There was an idea for what was going to happen last Wednesday. And you don't have to, you know, say that it's just silliness or divisiveness. Just read. Please read. Please take the time. Because that might not be a one-off, what happened, if we're not careful. We have to try to figure out how we got here in the first place. Listen to the words of the woman who got trampled to death, the 34-year-old woman who died when she got trampled to death. Her family says they don't know why she went. They tried to convince her not to, and they blame the president, and they blame the people who basically peddled these conspiracy ideas. She thought she was going there for a big revolution. She thought they were going to get inside the Capitol. The president was going to show up. And God knows what could happen, John, but part of the theories, the ideas, were public executions of political opponents. Now, Trump didn't say that himself, but he knows that the people who were showing up, that was part of their idea. He knows that. That is not new. The FBI knows that, John. We've got to get our heads around this. This is not made-up stuff, and this is not a fringe anymore. So that's why this is all happening. That's why we're looking at this going. And by the way, the president also, John, tweeted in advance of January 6th, be there, it's going to be wild. He has told his supporters to attack people at his rallies. This is not new. This is real stuff. And I'm going to stop now. Jeremy, you want to pick it up here? I'm sorry. I don't mean to disrespect John. I think John's calling in good faith. And John's worried that I am using this microphone to try to make divisive comments. And I take it seriously. I don't want to divide people. I want to respect people. I want to respect people who believe all kinds of things. But we've got to get a little bit of a shared reality here and realize how sort of fragile this moment is. So go ahead, Jeremy.
I agree, and I want to state my respect for something that John said, which is the desire to avoid bloodshed.
Yes.
We share that conviction that we should move forward without further bloodshed. The issue is just how to achieve that goal. Consequences for violent and seditious action, severe consequences, are warranted to stop bloodshed. They don't encourage it. They stop it. Because what we've seen over the last 4 years is a lack of accountability for conduct that threatens the integrity of our democracy. If you want to get into the details, almost a line by line detail of what Trump said, Seth Abramson wrote a 150 tweet takedown of the speech, a speech during which people were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." You would think that if the president was listening to a crowd chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," in response to his statements, he might say something about the impropriety of threatening to hang his vice president, but he didn't. He reveled in it.
He also said that what takes courage for Mike Pence is to do nothing.
Right. And he said the same thing for Congress. They're going to find out that what takes courage is to do nothing. And he said there would be hell all over the country. So there's a concept called stochastic terrorism, which is when a figure does not explicitly say, "I want you to go into this building and destroy it and kill someone," but says things that yield the same effect. And what we the horrible situation we're in is when we have a president that inflames a mob and knows he's doing it, and then the next day can say, "Oh, it was heinous and terrible and shouldn't have happened." And as I said before, we don't have a great solution for dealing with that. We don't want people to feel like by seeking justice in this situation we're seeking revenge, or that we're trying to make people feel like their hope that Trump gets reelected somehow is illegitimate, because everyone had the right to vote for Trump. But what we're trying to do, I think as everyone wants, is to avoid future bloodshed.
Yeah, and let me just endorse the idea. Revenge is a very dangerous idea, and I think it has to be resisted. Has to be resisted.
Absolutely.
Politically. It has to be. It just is not a productive emotion and sentiment. It's just not. So this cannot be, no matter what happens. It cannot be about political revenge or, you know, owning the other side just as they tried to own the libs. This is a very different scenario here. It's very different. And I think John in Penfield is in the spot where a lot of, and I don't know John's politics and seems like a nice person. And John, when we're allowed to do it, I'd love to buy you a coffee. That offer will stand. But, you know, if you're a conservative who thinks, well, this is just, you know, Democrats don't like Republicans, this is not like a Romney or McCain presidency or a George W. Bush presidency. This is in the category of self-coup. And there are a lot of people who are still ready to go to state houses, to go to Washington next week. They don't want to be done with this. They had some very serious ideas about what was about to happen last Wednesday, and people got killed. They dragged a police officer into the crowd and beat him to death. You know, so I don't think we should soft pedal what happened, but also what could have happened, what could have been even worse. And so when the president says today he didn't do anything wrong and everybody analyzed his words and they were fine, I mean, that's fantasy. And I think we have to have an agreement. If a Democrat calls a Secretary of State who's also a Democrat and says, you got to find the votes for me, you've got to do this, you know, I need 11,380 votes, find those votes. Every Democrat and every Republican and every American should respond to that call and say that person should never be elected to anything again. Not, well, you know, it was emotional. It was hard. He just wants to make sure. I mean, we're past that point. We got to be past that point. We've got to do this together. And David Frum just said, I'll ask Jeremy and Aaron about this. This is interesting. David Frum, former Bush speechwriter who coined the term axis of evil, he says, you want unity? Here's how you have unity. Republicans should vote for impeachment. Then there'll be unity. What do you think, Jeremy?
I think he's right. I think that Republicans have to make a hard choice right now, because Donald Trump still is still the presumptive favorite to win the nomination for president in 2024. Republicans need to decide if they're okay with that. Maybe, as you noted, Evan, their personal ambition will win out, and they'll say, I don't want to deal with Trump in 2024. Marco Rubio and other people who may want to run again will say, let's I'm better off without him. But I think that more importantly, people need to band together and realize, you know, the Republican Party will be just fine without Trump, as it was fine before him, and we can have our political differences and disagree about taxes and spending and the military and not have Trump involved. And I think Frum is right.
Let's squeeze in our only break here. And then we get a lot more feedback from listeners on the phones and via email as we talk about, I know it's a very sensitive and painful subject, but, you know, we're trying to just understand the moment here with people who understand the process. Professor Aaron Harold from SUNY Geneseo helping us understand it. Jeremy Scher, co-leader of Indivisible Rochester. Back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. On Wednesday, we're keeping our eye on Washington with possible impeachment hearings or proceedings. We'll bring you any of those proceedings live as they happen. And with things in flux, we want to make sure that you know we will have coverage of all of the events, including debate, any possible votes, and more. That's Wednesday here on WXXI. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Alan in Rochester, next in the phone. Go ahead, Alan.
Hi, Evan. Yes, I agree with everything that you and the panel are saying. My question was, and I'm sorry, I'm actually in a car wash right now.
Please be careful.
No, it's okay. I'm not driving. I'm just sitting here, and I was waiting, and I thought, I have a moment in the break. I'll just quickly go through the car wash, and I don't know if you can hear me. But
I can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay, great. So my question was, I agree with all of the sentiment and the reasons for proceeding with the 25th Amendment or the impeachment. My concern is...
Hold on.
My concern is what would...
There you go.
My concern is what would happen if the impeachment process failed? What happens if we're 100 plus days in, it goes up to the Senate, and for whatever reason, if it doesn't get through the Senate and the impeachment fails, how could this further embolden and exasperate the situation particularly when it comes to a federal election. And I'd actually just add to that as well. I've spent in the last couple of days, just out of interest, researching a website that is very popular amongst some of Trump's fans, and some of the more extreme sides of the viewpoint, probably the people that were going to D.C. And the rhetoric I'm already reading is saying, you know, basically the Republicans are just as bad as the Democrats. It's an us against them. You know, just really fueling this. And my concern is, how much could we potentially be pushing people more in that direction? More mainstream Republicans may start to believe that there has been something untoward going on. And what would happen if we didn't see an impeachment in the Senate?
Okay, Alan, thanks. And I'll kick that first to Professor Harold. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Alan, and thanks for reminding me that I also need a car wash. I think that you make a good point, and this is one reason why I think that an impeachment may, if an impeachment does happen, I think it would be better if this trial, if they did not hold the articles, if they did not wait 100 days. I mean, it's not quite that justice delayed is justice denied, but some kind of justice should be swift. If you're looking for an unequivocal moral condemnation of what the Trump administration has done, faster is better, if only because it gets it behind us. And, you know, what can happen in 100 days? New crises can arise, you know, that people start to waffle, they change their positions. And so, you know, there is a real danger that you know, I think as you wait, the chances of a conviction may go down.
Okay. You know, and maybe Jeremy would disagree with my analysis on this. My political analysis is always close to worthless anyway, I found out. But I thought Democrats probably should have foreseen that their last attempt at impeachment would not succeed and might even allow Trump to sort of claim victory from that whole process, which he did. But, you know, it's obviously a very different scenario this time around. I mean, Jeremy, are you concerned that you go through this process and he's sort of emboldened again?
Of course. There's no great solution because unless the party, the both parties can unite on this issue, and it's not this false vision of unity which some Republicans are professing, which is that we should unite behind no consequences, but that as you pointed out, that Frum said, that we should unite behind accountability, right? We should unite behind just saying this is unacceptable and he can't hold office again. So that would be, in my view, the ideal solution, and both parties can move forward despite whatever problems each has with the other. But we can just put behind us the idea that insurrection and sedition can go unpunished. What's the risk if impeachment does not lead to a conviction? Well, I don't think it'll be worse than failing to impeach at all. I think failing to impeach at all is the worst result, because that's just throwing up your hands and saying there's nothing we can do about it. Even though a mob broke into the Capitol and the lives of members of Congress were in danger and five people died, but hey, it's too close to the end of the term. And I'll just point out one more thing.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
My very last quick point is just that this is the most dangerous time for a coup. Right, because a lame duck president may feel that they have nothing to lose, and may attempt a coup because they would rather take their chances with remaining in power and subverting democracy. So doing nothing just can't be an option.
Professor?
Yeah, sorry about that. I would just add to that. I agree totally, but I would add to that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if there is an impeachment, it won't be. Or it won't only be for inciting violence. It will be for attempting to use violence to undermine a democratic election. The Congress was meeting in a joint session in a ceremonial role to count the votes. And Trump, I don't know whether he really believes this, but he claimed that Mike Pence had somehow the authority to simply declare the votes invalid. And that's, you know, that violates the most sacred tenet of any democracy, which is to respect the outcome of an election, even or especially when your party does not win.
Sure. And to the professor's point, Jeremy, you know, Mike Pence never really had the chance to invalidate, but the president said that he did. And it was pretty clear last Wednesday that Vice President Pence's life could be in danger, and that Republicans and Democrats were both concerned not only for themselves but for the vice president specifically because of what President Trump was doing to sort of stoke the anger at the vice president. And it's been reported by people who know the vice president pretty well, Jeremy, that he has not gotten a single phone call from the president since last week, that he's been furious about the way he was treated. In fact, Jim Inhofe, a Republican senator from Oklahoma, said that Pence said last Wednesday night, after everything I've done for him, he does this to me. And that reporters who know him well say that he is maybe understandably worried about invoking the 25th Amendment because he doesn't want to fear for his family's life. Do you have any empathy for that, Jeremy?
I have to have empathy for someone who fears for their life and their family's life. I have to. I can't imagine being in that situation. I just wish that he had done something over the last 4 years to rein in the president before it came to this, before he had to fear for the lives of his family and himself.
And producer Megan Mack pointing out Reuters reporting late last night that Trump and Pence apparently might have had their first conversation late last night, their first since Wednesday, after the vice president's office expressed anger that there had been no outreach at all to check on his safety. So
there was an article published saying something along the lines of that they worked out an agreement to basically stay in office together through the end of the term, a statement that in any other administration would be just almost comedic, that the vice president and the president had worked out a way to coexist for the last 8 days or 9 days of their term.
Let's get back to your phone calls. And as we do that, I'll address a caller off air said that it wasn't fair that I cut John off. And I shouldn't cut people off just because I don't like what they're saying. I don't think I did that with John from Penfield, who called earlier. He made his point. He thinks I'm being unfair in describing the president stoking the riot last Wednesday. But John also made it clear that he was not aware himself of a lot of the dynamics involved here. And a lot of people aren't. I've had a lot of reading to do myself. I have been lax in my own reading and understanding of this stuff. And I think I've just treated it like a fringe, faraway thing. And that was my fault.
It's hard to digest. And I just want to point out one thing that John mentioned that you actually took issue with, Evan, correctly, which is his statement that a woman was murdered. There was a woman who was shot to death by, most likely by Pence's Secret Service. Because she was part of a group advancing toward where Pence was being guarded. We don't want anyone to die. The loss of life is a tragedy, but it's not an issue where someone was murdered. It's an issue where the vice president's life may have been in danger.
She was climbing through a window that they had broken down to try to get into the chamber there. We should be sad when anyone's life is lost.
Right.
But it was just this.
No one should have died.
It was a curious way to describe it. Let's get Tony in Geneseo. Go ahead, Tony.
Hi. I think that it's completely legitimate to follow impeachment. I mean, the president's actions certainly run counter to the concept of the general welfare and domestic and tranquility. You know, that are enshrined in the preamble of the Constitution. And I'd like to remind the people out there like John that the preamble of the Constitution was added as a response to Shays' Rebellion. And Shays' Rebellion was a tax rebellion. So all those Tea Party people carrying those Do Not Tread on Me flags who think they're supporting the Constitution, that preamble was added to work against them, not to work in favor of them. And I'd like people to know that. And by the way, Daniel Shays is buried just down here, just south of Geneseo near Canisius Lake. Question, though, is do we need two-thirds or 67 people of the Senate, or do we need two-thirds of the people who show up for the vote? Because if we have the vote quickly, they may not all show up. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. Professor Harold?
I'm not an expert on the Senate rules, but it probably would be two-thirds of those in attendance, but I'm happy to be corrected on that. But I think it's very likely they would all show up. But I would say just to the other thing, good points that Tony makes, it's One thing our founders were very much afraid of were the prospect of angry mobs and demagogues stoking those mobs. And if there's two pieces of reading that I would recommend to your listeners, which I thought of on last Wednesday evening, would be the very first Federalist paper, Federalist One, where Alexander Hamilton talks about why the new Constitution was designed the way it was specifically in order to combat this kind of danger. And then also the reflections of the young Abraham Lincoln in a speech he gave in 1838 called The Address to the Young Men's Lyceum, which is entitled On the Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions, where he talks about this danger posed by mob violence. And he says in that speech that he says, as a country, as a polity, we are either going to live forever or die by suicide. He says if the only threats that America is ever going to face, he thinks, are those which come from ourselves.
I'll just add that I had the forethought to have the impeachment clause opened in front of me on my computer. So it actually says no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. So the answer is 2/3 of those who are there. So yeah, I don't know what would happen at the trial. I've seen it floated that maybe Republicans could give a soft conviction by simply not attending and reducing the threshold needed to get a conviction, but not having to vote for conviction.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
There's no telling what's going to happen.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. Roy in Rochester next. Keep it tight. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, I tuned in late, just in time to hear John, and I have to agree with you on the elements of that. Since Wednesday, I have my own thought about what, in a perfect world, justice would be for this, but we're not in a perfect world. And I look at this and I wonder sometimes if Nancy Pelosi's the last man in the Capitol and that she's going to have to take the whole thing over. But I had a question for you and for the professors. Okay, you got an auditorium full of people who stormed the Capitol. What is it that you want to say to them in your lecture?
That's a great question.
Yeah, Roy, thanks. I mean, I would just say from my perspective, you know, Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz know better. Some of the people who were in the Capitol had been convinced by the most powerful person in the world that their government was being infiltrated by child molesters and people who stole the election. Some of them, I'm not saying they shouldn't face accountability. I think we all should be accountable for our actions. But I am angry as an American what happened, but I'm also very sad. And I want to keep engaging people. I mean, we all probably have people in our orbits who are kind of dabbling in some of these ideas. I mean, Jeremy, what do you say?
I wish I had that answer.
Yeah.
I wish I had the answer to yield this result, to make people who feel like that their freedoms and rights are being stolen from them, to make those people feel the comfort knowing that there is no such conspiracy in place, that their rights are respected, and that if they lay down their arms and strive with everyone who accepts Biden's election for a better country, we can achieve it together. And I know that's a gross oversimplification, but and again, I have to stress, I don't know the words. I don't know the words to get us there, but that's what I want. I don't want people who are convinced that the election was fraudulent to disappear, to be forced to leave the country. I want them to simply understand that we can work together toward a future that's better for everyone, regardless of what you believe, color of your skin, the religion you practice, who you love, or anything else about your identity. And that the divisiveness is coming from people who seek to turn us against each other violently, rather than simply dividing people by disagreements over what our taxes are or other issues that in the end don't result in bloodshed.
I think that's beautifully said, Jeremy. And I wish we could get there too, because you know, we have to be able to disagree lovingly and find common respect and ground here. But there are those who are seeking to exploit misunderstanding and confusion.
I will add one thing. I don't think that we should tolerate hatred or intolerance. We should not tolerate white supremacy, racism. Yeah, yeah. But the question is, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
And the answer is not engage in further bloodshed or ruin lives. It's somehow reach a level of common understanding.
Okay, real quick here in our last 40 seconds here, Professor, some people are asking about censure. Is censure an option for Congress, Professor?
Yes, I think it is.
Okay, that's something
whether
that could
it's strong enough or powerful enough to send the message that needs to be sent is another question.
Okay, and Jeremy Scher, what do you think about censure?
I say use it, because it's just another tool that's available, but it's not enough on its own.
It's a both and, not an instead of situation, you think? Okay.
Every arrow in the quiver.
I want to thank our guests. I mean, this is not a comfortable conversation, I admit. And I want to ensure all listeners that we've got to keep engaging in these things together, hopefully again, with as much kindness and love as we can muster, but also being direct about what we expect in this country. Jeremy Scher is co-leader of Indivisible Rochester. Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Evan.
Aaron Harold, a professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations, coordinator of legal studies, co-director of the Forum on Constitutionalism and Democracy at SUNY Geneseo. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
From Rob, Megan, and me, thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow. Unless there's something going on in Washington, we'll have it for you on Member Supported Public Radio.